Blog Talk Radio.
Call him now.
Yeah, I'll call him.
Hi, Johnny boy. How are you tonight?
Good. How are you, Joanne?
I'm good, honey. How's everybody out there? Welcome to Applause
everybody.
Radio, everybody. We have a great
Everybody's
guest
doing
tonight.
Good.
Yep. Happy Wednesday. We have a great guest tonight to discuss a very apropos subject of people sending their kids back to school. Larry Strauss. He's not only an author, educator, but he's also, believe it or not, the son of Charlotte Rain, Mrs. Garrett, on the Facts of Life. So let's say thanks to our sponsors, and we'll welcome Larry right aboard. And if you guys want to call in to speak to Larry, have any questions, I hope he's okay with calls, 646-478-0999. And we are tonight giving away to our fifth caller. We've got coupons for free food to Joey Max, and we also have T-shirts to Joey Max, and we have a lot of autographed books from prior guests that we've had on. So let's just say thank you to our sponsors, the Hyde Bar and Bistro in Garfield, New Jersey, Precious Memory Video in Kintnersville, Pennsylvania, KWB Wines in South Africa, Tees for the Times and Other Stuff in Clifton, New Jersey, Syntech Productions in Anoka Harbor, New Jersey, Oleander Public Relations in Texas, Take a Break from Cancer.org for Pete's Sake, and Joey Max Hot Dog Truck and Cafe in Harrison, New Jersey, oral satisfaction guaranteed. Mr. Strauss, Larry Strauss, welcome to the show, sir. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Thank you. Great to be with you. I'm good.
Oh, thank you.
Hey, Larry.
Hi.
Hi. I just want to say, obviously, I'm a big fan of your mom's and always loved all the shows she was
thank
on.
You.
Facts of Life. Oh, my God. What's the one with Arnold? Different Strokes.
Different Strokes.
Yeah, there were so many that she was.
Car 54, where are you? I don't know how old you are, but.
Oh, God. Really? Wow. I didn't know she was in that, too.
62. Yeah, I was just a little rugrat when she was on that.
Wow.
She's
done so many other things. She's an esteemed actor, not a comedian. I mean, she started out as a serious actor and wound
that
up
was,
as a comedian.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
Yeah. And a singer, too.
She wanted to be, she wanted to do, you know, Eugene O'Neill and Strindberg and Shakespeare. She went to college and found out she was funny.
I went to high school and found out I was funny looking.
We're all funny. Yeah.
I was funny looking, so I had something going. Anyway, but I got to ask one question about Mom, because since we're focusing on you tonight, did she actually have a school teacher background or anything?
Oh God, no. Oh God, nothing at all. No, she never had that much patience for like. Teenager. No, she loved the girls. I mean, you know, she maintained friendships with them, you know, until the end of her life. But I mean, when they were teenagers, she used to like, I don't understand what's going on. I don't know. I don't get them. I don't get them. You know.
Oh God.
And no, she was not an educator at all. She was an actress, and you know, she, whatever was put in front of her was, you know, she sought the challenge of creating the character. And
well, growing up watching the show, I mean, did you get a sense of how caring an educator was that and made you want to go into that field, or no, it had nothing to do with it?
No, my parents definitely credit them with not only just my interest in it, but my talent in it and my success at it. But not because of her character. And I was already pretty old when she started doing that show. You know, my memories of my mother's an actress growing up were, you know, her, us being somewhere and somebody going, "I know you from somewhere. I know you, you know, you used to be in the butcher department at Bohack," or, you know, because she did commercials and people would recognize her, but they were never sure from where. But no, the thing that inspired me the most was I had a brother who was developmentally disabled. He was severely autistic and schizophrenic, epileptic. And, you know, he was 3.5 years older than me. And back then there was almost nothing, no support at all.
No.
You know, the schools wouldn't take them. I mean, now autistic children attend regular schools. I actually have a high functioning autistic young man in my class. And, you know, back then they were completely alone and people told them to institutionalize him. They were urged by doctors, professionals, including my mother's brother-in-law, who, you know, because that's what people did. I mean, it wasn't considered cruel. In fact, Arthur Miller, the great playwright, had a son similar, and he did institutionalize him. I mean, he never, the boy, you know, never lived with the family. My parents didn't do that.
Look at the Kennedys.
Right.
The one sister didn't even exist.
Right, right. I mean, yeah. Exactly. That's how they did it.
Yeah, well,
my parents wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it.
My older son is high-level functioning autistic, but he's on the spectrum, and thank God, like you said, there are so many programs and things available to us to help him along the way. And he attended regular school his entire school years. And now he's in
college. Oh, that's great.
And now
he's functioning,
has a job at Target, goes to school every day. And, you know, but I mean, well, not
that's
now.
That's great.
What's going on.
Right, right.
But
that's wonderful.
Without those programs, I don't know where I'd be.
And I should also give her credit. I mean, my mother, I found among her things letters from Mayor Wagner in New York, you know, correspondences about providing services for children like that. You know, my she did a lot. She helped start a school with the other parents, and, you know, and she got the city to provide a bus, and she was very active.
Wow.
And, you know, but what I saw growing up was I saw my parents just not give up on him. They loved him so much that they until finally it became impossible, and they sent him away. They had to send him away. And then ultimately he was institutionalized, but in a really good facility where that they monitored and maintained. And, you know, so I credit my parents with my determination and belief in students. Over the years, I have refused to give up on students, even when they are, you know, absolutely, you know, appear to be incorrigible, impossible to, you know, I'm including gang members who
you're in a lot of inner city.
I teach in South LA, and, you know, it's a distressed community.
Yeah.
A lot of poverty, a lot of drug problems, and gang violence. You know, it's where the Crips and Bloods originated. And I've had students who, you know, seem to want to go in a different direction, but seem like they just couldn't, like they were beyond reaching, but I never gave up on them. And, you know, sometimes just having somebody who believes in you don't believe in themselves. They're very quick to be down on themselves. They're very quick to give up on themselves.
The adults have to,
even when we might think the kid's probably not going to make it, you have to still believe in them, and you have to let them know you believe in them. And that's what my parents did, and that's what I, you know, that's what I've been doing for 30 years.
Right. Well, before we go on, one more time, I want to question in regard to Facts of Life. Did your mom have anything to do with Jerry coming on, Cousin Jerry?
Oh yeah, absolutely. That
I
was.
I figured that.
You know, I don't know if she discovered her specifically, or but I think she was, you know, for the first few seasons, she was really. She went to war with the producers and writers about the content of the show. She's like,
right, everybody was too perfect.
Yeah, they, you know, the, she didn't want a jokey show. Like, right. You know, and sitcoms back then tended to be, you know, and a lot of them now, they tend to be like set up, punchline, set up, you know.
Yeah, on the corny side, but that's.
She wanted more organic humor and, you know, and more, just more serious stuff. And
yeah.
So I think she, you know, she, yeah, it was a big deal for her, like, to destigmatize, you know, people who are challenged like
right.
that. And
right.
Jerry Jewell, I mean, what a courageous woman, you know, to be a comedian, a
right.
stand-up comedian, get up in front of a bunch of drunk people who are, you know, potentially abusive and combative.
Right.
And to get up there with your cerebral palsy and expose yourself to that and just say, I'm a comedian, I'm going to be a comedian. And, you know, I was brought to tears. I did Lisa Welchel now has a show called Collector's Call.
Yes, yes, I've seen it, yes.
Oh, have you, and she asked me if I would, you know, come on and just show some of the things that I've found.
Oh, I must
mother.
Have missed that episode.
And,
like,
yeah, yeah, it was great. You know, it was really, you know, to have Lisa there. I mean, I have things, you know, from the set, my mother
right.
saved, props, just a few. And I have a card, a little card that Lisa wrote to my mother after the shooting the pilot. You know, she must have been like 14 or 15 years old. And it's this beautiful little, you know, thank you. And, you know, I said, you know, I had shown her, I had scanned it and sent her a copy of it just to show her, like, hey, you obviously were raised really well, you know, for a kid to do that. And, but Jerry came on the show as a surprise guest.
Yeah.
Jerry Jewell. And the thing that she showed off was a scrapbook that she had made and that had been stolen out of her Hollywood apartment and then turned up later. Like somebody, it made the rounds and then some collector bought it and then I guess realized that it had been stolen and contacted her and said, you know, I can't keep this. This is yours. You should. So she had it with her and, you know, it was hard not to cry seeing every success that she had had, you know, where she had broken a barrier. You know, it's all right there on the page.
Why would somebody steal that? What the hell?
Oh, no. They broke into her apartment and stole everything.
Oh,
that
God.
Was just like part of it. No, they didn't break in and steal that. I'm sure.
No,
they
I'm
were,
just saying, but what
yeah,
you
right.
Mean,
why not leave that?
I mean,
why not leave
right.
it?
I
hey,
mean,
I had my car broken into, and the thief took my it looked like a computer bag. Mm-hmm. It was full of papers like essays and, you know, all student work. It was like a, 3 inches thick of student work.
Wow.
Like all the thieves got. And, you know, my students all got A's and I didn't have to read them. So the win-win for everyone, except for the thief. The thief got stuck with.
Are you still close with the cast? I mean, I know you tight knit groups. So are you still close with them, or
yeah?
Like
I was, you know, not, you know. I mean, we were all very friendly, and you know, I used to see them. Sometimes I'd take my mother to events and stuff. But no, I mean, I had my own life. I had my own thing going on. I was not, you know, when the show started in the late 70s, so I was almost 20.
You were older than them. You were older than them.
Yeah, I'm older than all those guys. I was living on my own. I was, you know, I was sort of doing my own thing. But we were always very friendly. And when my mother passed away, I got calls from all of them, like right away. They all called. Kim and excuse me, Kim flew in from Atlanta.
Nice.
Mindy lives out here. She was there. She was at the memorial. They both spoke at the memorial.
Mm-hmm.
Lisa and Nancy. Nancy just could not. She could not. Man, I think she's doing a play somewhere. She was heartbroken. She really wanted to be there. Lisa,
yeah, your mom was like a second mom to them. I mean, you know.
Yeah. And but you know, I talk to them occasionally. By the way, Kim at the memorial, Kim and I got to talking. She ended up doing the audiobook of my last novel.
Oh, you're kidding.
So if you go, it's called Now's the Time by Larry
cool.
Strauss, narrated by Kim Fields. You know, you find it on Amazon or Audible. It's sort of a facts of life. I mean, it's a 1950s/70s jazz mystery,
and she did
the narration. Yeah,
wow.
She did a great job.
Well, I wanted to ask, I mean, you've written over a dozen books. The only one that I know of off the top of my head is the one you co-wrote with your mother, her autobiography, The Facts of My Life. So what other books and subjects do you have out there right now? Are they all educational-based, fiction, nonfiction?
Four novels. My fifth one will be out next year. A variety of different kinds of fiction.
Mm.
I did write. I have a book called Students First and Other Lies, which is a compilation of my education writing from a few years ago.
Okay.
My publisher is putting together another collection. I wrote for the Huffington Post for a while. Now I write mostly for USA Today.
I didn't know that.
I do op-eds. Yeah, I'm one of their opinion columnists too. So he wants to collect those, but that probably won't be for a while.
Yeah. So now, what in God's name made you want to be an advocate for kids going back to school right now with the pandemic? I mean,
Well, no. I'm not.
You're not an advocate.
I'm an advocate for listening to doctors and scientists. No. I think we should go back as soon as we can. But I think that's going to be determined by how we can get control of this virus. And I think, you know, as an educator, I mean, I feel kind of disappointed in, you know, our response to it. As I think a lot of people are, disappointed in the leadership and disappointed in selfish people where I live, the people are renting out big houses in the hills and having house parties because the bars and clubs are all closed.
Nice.
They're having private clubs and, you know, super spreaders.
Right. Well, I think if summer hadn't hit, we'd have a better chance because who the hell wants to go out when it's cold, you know? So I think we'd have a lot better chance if it wasn't summertime and it just happened to hit at the same time. And it's like everybody wants to go out. I mean, you know.
It's hard. I mean, people used to go to the mall just to get air conditioning or go sit in a movie. If you're living in a small place with no AC, I sympathize, but it's just bad. Like the more we don't follow the rules, the longer it's going to be. And that's the thing about reopening schools is if we don't do it right, we're going to be closed again. And then we're going to be closed even longer. And what happened to my students when we closed I imagine what happened to students everywhere is they weren't only upset because they lost this centerpiece of their lives and the connection with their friends and whatever teachers they find useful. But it was the instability. It just suddenly happened. Suddenly, it was like the adults in the world don't know what the hell we're doing. And that's really destabilizing to kids. Now, it may always have been true that we don't know what we're doing. And it's true. I often tell students, you know, as they're approaching adulthood, like, if you feel like you're unprepared to, you know, go to college, you know, go for your job interview, whatever it is that you have to face, you feel unprepared. We do too. We just, you know, we're better at faking it. But younger kids, the illusion is important to them, you know, that we know what we're doing. And we've really exposed ourselves, I think, you know.
But don't trust anybody over 30.
Yeah, we're not planning for what we know was going to happen. I remember at the end of the Bush administration, the second Bush, Bush Jr., at the end of his administration, I remember him making a speech about preparing for a global pandemic. I remember that. I still remember thinking like, oh my God, I hope that never happens.
Right.
But thinking like, well, you know, I'm glad the government's thinking about it and thinking ahead.
Well, who knew we would experience this in our lifetime? You kidding me?
Right. Well,
you know.
Right. I think what I was worried about was the superbugs, you know, the bacteria that, you know, that's resistant to antibiotics. You know, for years we've been hearing about that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I tell my students, I mean, I'm not a health teacher, I'm an English teacher, but I mean, they need to hear this. I'm on the soapbox all the time about, you know, you got to keep your immune system up. That's your only defense, you know, whatever's happening with the healthcare system and whatever is happening with, you know, the drugs and their ability to fight that, you know, bacterial infection, all that stuff. The best defense you can have is, you know, stop eating chips all day,
right.
Get enough sleep,
right.
You know, drink water instead of soda, like these simple things, that, you know,
right.
Exercise. When you have a PE class, don't avoid exercise, you know.
Right, and shocking, there was a run on toilet paper. It should have been a run on vitamins and stuff like that.
Right, yeah, I know.
Plenty of those available.
People don't always think of that.
Well, in regard to, you know, you teach in the inner cities. I mean, you know, the 1918 flu, I don't have the right year, 1918.
Spanish flu, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I believe New York, Chicago, and New Haven were the last cities to close down. And the reason they did, I think, this is my opinion, is that, you know, the kids came from not great households, and going to school was so much better.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's the way they looked at it. They'd rather get the kids out of the tenement houses.
Yeah, well, they were safer.
Where, you know, and they'd be safer.
Yeah,
so,
I read about this.
And do you feel that way with your kids?
No, but back then they had so many nurses in the schools because of that. Like,
right.
Even pre-pandemic, they used the schools as health centers, and so they had this gigantic health infrastructure in the schools. So in a way, it made sense to get kids in, even though they would be in contact with each other, because, you know, they were spreading it anyway. I think now things are very different now. And, you know, we don't. I mean, my union just won last year. We went on strike and won having a nurse in every school. Like, there wasn't even a nurse in every school. We had itinerant nurses who were one day here, one day there. So, you know, we don't have that infrastructure to deal with it. And, but, you know, that said, I mean, the kids, some kids are very safe and well taken care of at home, and others are not. And we have to mitigate a lot of, you know, neglect, and I mean, we have to report it if it's, you know, if it's criminal, but sometimes it's just poverty. I mean, sometimes we have kids who they're being fed, but it's not enough, or they're living in very crowded conditions because that's all their parents can afford.
Well,
and
it's funny, before this happened, I had no idea how many kids we were feeding at schools. I mean, I knew there was free lunch programs, but I had no idea how many kids depended on eating at school.
Oh, yeah. I know in my school district, and I assume because it's a federal program that this is everywhere, it's actually two meals a day. And you know, the parks in the inner city, the parks also feed kids. Like, I used to, I coached basketball for years, and for most of that time, my school didn't have a gym. So we went to a public park, and the park director was beating kids who, you know, they were latchkey kids, or they, you know, some of them had parents who were drug addicted. They weren't really, and they were just like hanging out at the park because they didn't want to go home. Anyway, they feed them. So there's a lot of feeding going on. And then on top of that, some of us are feeding kids too.
Right,
we're feeding
right.
kids all day.
Right.
Yeah, you know, I've had kids faint from hunger because all they ate was the food at school, and it wasn't enough. And
right.
so, you know, we would, you know, some of the teachers would buy gift cards to like Subway or, you know, fast food so that they could eat over the weekend. You sure?
Oh,
to eat over
being,
the
hey,
being,
hey, Larry.
In the,
yeah.
I'm sorry, Johnny. Go ahead.
Yeah, I got a question for you.
Sure.
We don't know how long this is going to go on, the pandemic, and if the schools will
yeah.
open in, you know, the fall. Now, my question is for you. Let's take it from the other side. All the people paying school taxes and everything, do you think it's right for them to continue to pay the school taxes without the teachers actually going to school for the upkeep of the school? And also, why can't we take some of those, the money that we're putting towards the school, and put it directly to these people who need the two meals a day, give it to the kids in some way, set up some type of thing where these kids can go and get these meals because they're not getting anything right now.
Right. Well, actually, I can only speak for my school district, but I think this is going on pretty much every, at least in big cities. No, my school district is still feeding people. They have feeding centers. People come in, no questions asked. They give them meals. So that money is actually not even enough because the school district is probably feeding more people now because of, you know, because of people's financial distress.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as
That's
where
right.
money's going, because of distance learning, and we are, you know, schools. I'm constantly correcting people who say, when do you think we're going to open the schools? Because as far as I'm concerned, school's open. The campus is closed, but the school is open. I've got 200 students. I'm getting, you know, who I'm still teaching. They get on. We get on Zoom. We have classes. They have assignments. They call me. They, you know, we've emailed back and forth. I mean, there's a lot of teaching going on. Of course, it's much harder in this environment, although actually some parts of it are, there's some things you can do better in this environment, especially with troubled kids who need more attention, but, you know, who need a particular kind of attention. But no, you know, some of us are working much longer hours. So, you know, when I hear people suggesting, like I read somewhere that, you know, a lot of people surveyed said teachers' salaries should be cut, and I don't quite get that because we're really being asked to do more. Now, honestly, there are some teachers who probably aren't, who are probably, you know, who are not motivated, who don't care enough about kids, probably shouldn't be teaching, and they're sort of disappearing. My nephew had some teachers like that. He's in middle school. It disappeared on them last spring. But, you know, and that, of course, should be monitored. But the truth is, at any time, whether we're on campus or not, there are teachers who go above and beyond, and there are teachers who, you know, do their job and are professionals, and then there are teachers who are not. And, you know, it's unfortunate that that our kids are subjected to that. And
right.
I don't think there are that many teachers who fit that category, but I think we should be honest about it.
Well, I was going to say, I think there's a small percentage that are there just for a paycheck, and a large percentage who really love and care for the kids.
Yeah. I think what happens, I think the teachers who, you know, who we would like to remove or make better, I think in some cases their working conditions have made them kind of just hopeless and cynical.
Yeah.
And they probably, you know, they probably haven't had adequate support become, you know, as teachers. You know, I was very fortunate, and I have I have a I have a background that prepared me better to do this. You know, I mean, my experiences growing up with my brother, the patience that I developed. Also, you know, I did not grow up in a glamorous world of, you know, a television star's son. Again, my mother didn't become a star until I was an adult. And we lived on West 106th Street in Manhattan before gentrification, you know, in a building that now is a doorman. But when I was growing up, we had a block association to protect ourselves. Crime was so bad.
At that time, yeah.
Yeah, New York in the 70s. And, you know, I had very diverse friends growing up. You know, I had a lot of, you know, I had a lot of very tough friends, you know, way we proved ourselves with fighting and all that. So, you know, for me to go into a tough school environment, I understand it. You know, it doesn't feel scary to me, and the kids don't feel threatening to me at all. They feel, to me, they seem vulnerable when they're putting that front up and trying to be threatening. I see through it. And so, you know, it's just a lot easier for me. But so many teachers, they grow up in the suburbs. They come, you know, to teach in distressed communities, and they're not really prepared, and they're overwhelmed. And the kids will give you the impression that they don't care. They don't care about you. They don't care about what you're teaching. And,
right, but if
you gave them
the attention they needed, I'm sure they do
because they do care. It's all an act. It's a test.
Right.
It's like
right.
a test to see, like, do you really care about me?
Right.
Because I'm going to act the worst I can possibly act, and you know, and you're going to have to see through that. And
right.
and we don't prepare teachers very well to do that.
Well, how do you manage to do it with 200 kids? How do you manage to be the second father to 200 kids? Because basically that's what a teacher is. We that way, and that's how we feel. Like you said.
Yeah, and they don't, you know, they don't all need a second father, but some of them need a first father.
Right,
and,
but you become
and,
that figure, you know,
right,
like
but,
that sense, the feeling,
yeah.
everything.
No, it's a little overwhelming sometimes, and it's a lot of work, and it's an illusion. You know, you have to make every kid feel special. You know, when
right.
of course, obviously, they can't all be special because there's all of them collectively.
Right.
But you know, you learn how to do it. You learn how to identify who needs a little special attention today.
Right.
And you know, how are you going to give it to them? But yeah, it's easy to get emotionally burned out on it. It can be overwhelming, for sure.
Well, before we go on your opinions for, you know, opening safely and getting kids back in school, tell us about Students First and Other Lies. Is that your new book that's out? And what's involved in that? What's inside?
It's a series of related essays, opinion pieces about, you know, just what needs to happen in education, what is wrong with education, and what's right in our schools. And, you know, I try to be very honest, cut through the BS, and I mean, I see things for what they are. There isn't a lot of writing about this subject from teachers, and the writing that is from teachers is often from former teachers who didn't teach very long.
Right.
There aren't too many of us who've put in three decades and have a voice in the discussion.
I think it's a dying breed. I do.
You know, well, I mean, for one thing, when you're teaching a full load, there isn't a lot of time to be a journalist. So, you know, And I think what happens to some people is they have this overwhelming few years in the classroom, and then they have a lot to say about it, and a lot of very important good things to say about it. But there's a difference between a rookie who's had this like shocking epiphany, and you know, a 20 or 30 year vet who understands the shock, but also understands the subtleties and the you know, what kids are really about and what adults are really about and why there's and why things work and why other things don't work.
Right.
An example is, you know, and this, I think this occurs to people fairly soon if they're thinking about it, but our schools are the leadership of our schools is this, it's this external administrative, it's like this corporate/military model, you know, like in the military, the generals and the colonels and, you know, and on down, chain of command, and then on down to the soldiers out in the field. And the soldiers are the ones actually fighting the war, but they really need the everybody else making their plans and figuring out and getting them their equipment and everything. And, you know, in education, it's different. Well, and in the corporate model, you know, the assembly line workers or the people, you know, who are paid the least, they may work hard, but their contribution, you know, they're not the innovators of the company. You know, they're not the ones who take the risks. In education, the teacher is the innovator. The teacher is the risk taker. And the teacher is really the one who does the vast majority of the instruction, which is the only purpose of the school. Well, at least as an educational institution, right? We do also feed children. We also give them medical care, and we also, you know, we make sure they're safe and all that. But as far as the educational component, it doesn't make sense to have somebody. To have, you know, a secretary of education and then state secretaries of education and then school district superintendents and on down to the teacher. The teacher knows how to teach better than any of those people. None of those people could last 5 minutes in my class. They don't know how to do this. And for them to be in charge, it's just, it ends up, you end up with so much wasted time and money where you know, the decisions that are made about how we teach kids are uninformed by people who don't know. So the model should be more like a law firm. The experts, the teachers who know their craft, understand students, understand the school, they should be in charge instructionally of the school. You should also have a CEO or CFO. You should have somebody who can order, you know, make sure supplies get ordered, make sure security gets, you know, taken care of. All the more business oriented aspects of a school. Yeah, those should, but who should be in charge? But that person should work for us, the teachers, not the other way around. We should be in charge of the school. We care more about the students. We know more about how to teach them. We know more about what we need in order to give them what they need. So the whole system is backwards. And as far as I'm concerned, as long as it continues that way, you know, we're just going to be, you know, you're going to have some good teachers going out of their way to overcome a system that's fatally flawed.
Yeah. Well, it's an ongoing story, you know, it'll never end. So your opinion on distance learning during the pandemic, and how does it work?
Yeah, how does it work?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's so hard. And,
yeah,
and
good question.
You know, how do we make it better? How do you have any advice for parents out there, kids who are struggling with the online virtual learning?
Well, you know, the first thing is teachers have to be more sympathetic to parents. But, you know, as far as being a parent, I think you got to be patient. I think you got to try to communicate with teachers. Most of us will respond to you, parents. If you reach out to us, sometimes it's a little overwhelming with 150 or 200 students to reach out to all of you.
Right.
But I always, when I get a message, email message or phone message from a parent, I call. I usually leave my home number. Usually we can straighten things out, but you know, I think parents need to be, if you reach out to a teacher and they don't get back to you, keep trying, and then if they don't respond after a few messages, CC the principal, and if the principal doesn't help you, CC the principal and the principal's boss. You got to find out, because there is that chain of command. I don't think it's a good thing, but it exists. And if the superintendent or the assistant superintendent of schools gets a bunch of angry messages from a parent, they're going to get on the phone and call that principal and say, what is going on at your school? And the principal is going to turn around and get on that teacher, and you're going to get results. So, you know, if that's happening, then, you know, by all means. And sometimes communication is important, because otherwise, you know, some parents are relying on their kid who may not be honest, or may be honest but just clueless about what's going on, you know, as far as what am I supposed to do. You know, I know that as a teacher, we're trying really hard to make this a meaningful experience for students in the pandemic. And
well, I know parents appreciate you guys a hell of a lot more, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they're not happy that things are like this, but it's not, you know, you realize, like, it's not easy taking care of kids all day if you haven't been doing it. It's you know, and especially, and look, and it's harder when they're your own kids. I mean, let's face it, I've raised three kids, and it's different going to school, going to work, and working in a school. They're not my kids, you know, they're somebody else's, and they respond to me very differently than they would to their parents, and I mean that in a good way.
Right.
You know, especially, you know, older teenagers just, you know, they need other adults in their life. They it can't be their parents. It just doesn't feel right, because they're trying to be adults themselves, and they don't feel like adults when they're with their parents.
Yeah, I know. It's funny that you're saying that. My son, I don't remember what he was doing with his friend or something. I said, I'm cool, but come on. You know, come on. You know, I can be cool, but come on. You know,
yeah.
I don't remember what he said. That
no, thing. Yeah. No, exactly.
They were out front playing basketball till 11:30 or something, and I was like, listen, the neighbor's got to get up, whatever, blah, blah, blah. I said, I'm cool, but come on. You know, this shit, we got to stop. But, you know.
Yeah. I'm cool, but I'm being a pushover right now, aren't
right.
I?
Exactly. Yeah. But I did want to ask you, do you think the virus, in your opinion, do you think the virus exposed any inadequacies in the education, and what were they, and how do you think we could fix it or make it better?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, look, if some kids are not fully engaged in distance learning because they've got distractions at home, because they're, you know, they're having emotional distress, but there's an amount of disengagement that was always there. We just didn't notice it. The kid was in our class and staring at us, and you know, in some cases, they weren't really as engaged as we thought they were. So I think, you know, I told some of my colleagues, like, look, if before the pandemic your classes were going well and your kids believed in you and you had a strong relationship with them, they're showing up for your class now, because they showed up for my class. The ones who didn't show up were the first thing in the morning, 8 o'clock in the morning. They were seniors. A lot of them had gotten jobs to help their families, and they were very honest with it. They reached out and they said, I wish I could come, but I can't. I can't make it at 8 o'clock. I'm either going to work or I work till midnight or 2 o'clock in the morning. Another interesting thing that happened was a lot of teenagers who lived in small living situations where they don't have their own rooms, they're constantly around their family. They're staying up all night because that's the only time they can have to themselves. Mm. And it's like they can't escape. Teenagers so desperately need space from their parents and their families to become themselves, to become who they're going to become. It's almost like a physical thing. And so I think they started staying up all night in order to do that. And so consequently, you know, if I could have had my classes at 10 o'clock at night, I think I would have had a lot more attendance with those than 8 o'clock in the morning. Yeah. But I had groups who met later in the day who they didn't, when school was over, they were like, well, can we still meet? I mean, we're in a pandemic. Nobody's going anywhere. Like, we're still having class the next week.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean,
you guys open early, right? You're back to school now, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We did some trainings this week. So tomorrow's actually our first day with students.
Are you in-house or are you doing virtual?
Oh, no, we're virtual. Our school system.
Yeah.
No, our L.A. County is, actually, the school district made that decision, but L.A. County would have overridden it anyway. We still have too high a number of new cases. The rate, I forget what they call it, the rate of positive tests, you know, to tests. The numbers are all too high for us to go back in person. Mm-hmm. When we do, which hopefully will be this semester. So I have no way of knowing. It'll be a hybrid. It'll be, you know, social distance, smaller classes. I mean, that's something. Look, that's maybe the biggest, you know, problem we expose in our education system is our schools are overcrowded. I mean, we didn't expose it. We already knew it. But just how bad that is. Our schools
right,
are overcrowded.
How do you distance all these kids?
Right, and under normal circumstances, they're all getting each other sick all the time and getting us sick because we're packed in with each other, and you know, class schools don't have adequate ventilation. I mean, there's a lot of we have underinvested in most of our students, and I say that knowing that somebody listening to this is probably saying, I'm a taxpayer and look at how many billions of dollars we spend on education. It has to be enough. Well, some of that money is misspent because again, the leadership structures are backwards. If teachers were running things, you know, we would know where the money should go and what's a waste of money. And, you know, believe me, the consulting fees and the school districts and the corruption, I mean, there's that movie on HBO about the Roslyn School District called Bad Education, a true story. $11 million embezzled by a school superintendent and caught by a student reporter. It's a great story. But I think for every case like that where it's just blatant criminality, there's 1,000 cases where there's like, it's going on and it's legal, but it shouldn't be legal. It's like, it's wasted. And I mean, we spent, our school district blew like billions of dollars on iPads, you know, paid too much for them. It's just disaster. It almost ended up in a criminal investigation.
I guess it was the rush to get them. I don't know. Listen, I think we have a caller, Larry. Would you be interested in taking a call?
Sure.
Cool. Johnny, we have a call or no?
Yes, we do. Let's see. I got a caller. You're on the air. Caller?
You're on the air.
Yeah, I'm calling from the Midwest. How are you?
Hi, thanks for calling Applause Radio Show. You're on the phone with Larry Strauss. You have a question for Larry?
Yeah, I was going to make a statement. I heard you say that what your school district could do, the state could override. But I'm going to tell you how it is in Missouri. The Missouri Constitution and also Missouri statutes give that power of decision for the books, curriculum, and teaching instructions to the district and the people of the district themselves. And it states that the state cannot mandate, you know, to districts on how their children are taught. So, you know, around here in the St. Louis Errol, you got distant learning. You got kids are attending the classrooms. My grandson attends LSU.
Are you a teacher, sir?
No, I'm not a teacher. I'm a parent.
Oh, okay. Okay,
no, no, he's
okay.
Thank you. I mean, I know it's different in different parts of the country.
Yeah.
And I'm
it is.
You know, I'm not sure that it shouldn't. I'm not sure that it's not better to leave it to school districts. Actually, it's not the state. It was the county of L.A. I think that overrode it. But you know, maybe it wasn't by law. Maybe it was more of an advisory thing where they convinced them not to do it. But I know that there are school districts in L.A. County.
Mm-hmm.
L.A. County has, you know, many. It has like 100 cities along with L.A. And I know of at least one school district that was going to open a hybrid model, and the county either advised them not to or overrode them. But yeah, I'm not surprised that in many places, yeah, you have neighboring
areas. And you know, one other
thing,
too. Yeah. In some schools, in some classes, they don't have certified teachers. They have people who come out of the industry who have a profession or work at the subject that they're teaching. And I even noticed a school there in Los Angeles on Slauson Avenue that had that same model where people that works in the industry come in and they teach, well, it's math or, you know, disciplines that's pertaining to of this subject learning. But I just want to
add
that.
It might be Hawkins. I'm trying to think what high schools are on Slauson. But I know that.
So six in Slauson. It's Marcus Garvey Academy.
Oh, okay. Oh, it's charter school. Yeah, I don't. I know that in most school districts, they, because of No Child Left Behind, you have to have a certificated teacher. But it's interesting you bring that up, because I think if we wanted to open schools now,
mm-hmm.
We could have planned to do it despite all the problems with the virus. If we decided in March, we're going to open the schools no matter what, there's a price tag on it. And the price tag would have been enormous, because we would have had to increase capacity of schools. We would have had to go out and find people to teach, either certificated or maybe not, maybe just trained and qualified and fingerprinted. And, you know, we could have created a system where there were 15 kids in a classroom where they were spread out enough, and where you had enough nurses and testing capacity in the schools. Like, if you just made a list of what would it take to open schools, it would be exorbitantly expensive. But I'm not sure it would not have been worth it to do that, to spend the time and the money to say, we're, you know. But I think what happened was in March, a lot of people were delusional. And they said, oh, this will be over. This will be over. I know this is going to go away. It's going to go away. And that's the problem, is we didn't listen to the experts who said, vaccine, year to 18 months. This thing's not going anywhere. We could have planned it so that every kid would be going back to school right now. And
Was it Atlanta where schools did go back and they shut down immediately?
Georgia.
Because over 200 kids got sick?
It was somewhere in Georgia. And I got to tell you, when I saw that picture, the kids crowd in the classroom, I mean, I was horrified.
That's what the halls look like in my school district here.
Right. That's what it normally looks like. But there was a part of me that said, hey, if they can stay open, that's great. It's great. I'm happy for them. And maybe we'll learn how we can open up. But the truth is, it was a mistake. And now their kids are probably not learning anything. They open, they close, they're not set up. Are they suddenly in distance learning? Everyone's probably confused. I mean, I'm speculating. I could be wrong. But so at least if you face reality and say, we're not going to be able to open, or we're going to be able to open on a very limited basis, then you can at least provide some kind of instruction to kids. And I think we should be sending people out to check on the most vulnerable students. I think we should be figuring out how to get a few of them into the building at a time, the ones who really, really need it the most. I'm all for it. I say whatever number that is of kids you can have in the building, get them in. Because
what is your opinion on if we were able to go back to schools in certain states, how do you think they should go about it?
I mean, I think we got to listen to the experts, but right, we have to, we got to figure out how to do it so that we don't have to close again. Mm-hmm. If we're taking risks and we may have to close again, it's not worth it, because the damage you do to those kids when mm-hmm. you, it's like we're open, we're closed, and then what's going to happen the next time you open? Who's going to trust it?
Listen. My son was graduating high school this year, had no idea that he was saying goodbye to his friends forever, and missed everything, like every other kid in the country.
Oh, my God. I know. It's terrible.
Graduation, and had no idea that they were never going to see these people again. Had they known, maybe they would have said goodbye differently, or you know what I'm saying? I mean, and my son, who is, like I said, borderline autistic, on the cusp, we're having trouble with him because he needs structure. He needs to get up in the morning, get in the damn car, drive to school, be there.
Yeah.
Home, he's getting up whenever he wants.
Yeah.
And the video games are right next to him. So guess what he's doing?
Of course.
So, I mean, and you could talk to your blue in the face, and he just, and it is great to suffer for it. I mean, he's definitely...
Sure.
You know, he didn't fail, but he definitely dropped.
Well, but also, you know, kids don't have the capacity to think in the way that we do about the future.
Mm.
Like, you know, most of us by the time we get into our 30s, 40s, we understand that what I do today is going to have consequences tomorrow and 5 years from now. We know that. We start to be able to process things that way. Kids don't really have that. They're still learning how to do that. And so when you shut everything down and you have kids at home not going to school, the idea of going to college is no longer exists. I mean, they can tell themselves, yeah, this is going to be over one day, but they don't believe it in the way that, or they don't understand it in the way we do, that they're going to have a future, that this is going to be over one day. And you know, what they do now, the decisions they make now are going to have an impact. That doesn't seem real to them. It seems less real than ever because everything that they had that was in their life has now disappeared.
Right.
So,
well, my other guy, he was going away and then found out the majority of his classes were online. I said, you're not going anywhere then. I mean,
where was he
going to
go?
He was going to Rowan in Jersey.
Oh. Yeah, yes. My son was going to Emerson in Boston when he just finished his second year, mm-hmm. and we agonized about him going back.
Well, that was my main problem.
Year.
I didn't want him to go, but it was his choice. You know,
it's
his choice.
Yeah.
It was killing me.
We convinced him. Yeah, we convinced our son, and he was upset when his buddies started going back, arriving back at school, and they were, mm-hmm. you know, and he was hearing from them and they were all together. But now he's like, that was the best decision I ever made. You know, they're not having parties. They're not even, he's in a fraternity. They just had a meeting on Zoom, even though they're all in this. So he's still in the fraternity meeting from his house in LA because they're not allowed to physically get together.
Well, I'm glad you told me that because I'm going to tell my son because he was disappointed too. And because, like I said, I was pushing, saying, you know,
he's going to be disappointed until things go bad. And I hope they don't. But already, you know, just this morning, Notre Dame and Michigan State announced all online this semester. Now, I remember in the spring, Notre Dame was one of the first. Their college president was all over TV saying, we're going to do this, we're going to do it right, we know what we're doing, we're having school, you know. And, you know, the reality is they figured out we can't do it. Of course, they've already got everyone's tuition money.
Right.
I mean, it's a little bit of a con job.
we made a decision before we paid. That's it. We were like, we got to make a decision now.
Yeah. Well, that was our thing. Like, we're not,
right.
I think it's Scott, his name is Scott Galloway. I don't know if you know him. He's a,
no.
He's a really smart guy. He's a professor at NYU, I think.
No, definitely.
And he's got a podcast and he appears a lot on TV. And he called this the hallucination. We're in the hallucination phase about opening colleges. And but he said, you know, universities have a serious problem, which is they're forced to offer what is essentially a Netflix education at a price that is, you know, a lot more than Netflix. And, you know, are people willing to pay $50,000 for private or more for private university education that they get on the small screen of a computer?
Right.
And
right.
Is it worth it? And I think the answer is obviously no, it's not worth it.
Right.
The most elite schools like Harvard and Stanford, they can get away with it because their degree is worth the money,
right.
Just having a degree. But if you're not one of those elite schools, then your price is inflated. And that's, you know, again, getting back to your question, what are we exposing about, you know, the education system in the pandemic. And that's one thing. Everybody knows it's ridiculously expensive and yeah, it's not worth it. And it shouldn't cost that much. It just
right.
shouldn't cost that much. There's no reason it has to cost that much
right.
to get a college education. You know,
right. I know. Let me ask you this. Have you heard or seen more cyberbullying now that the kids are online more with the school?
No, I haven't. What we did have was we had an incident at our school last spring, right after the George Floyd protest started. We had a situation where some students wanted to express themselves about it and how they felt, you know, how important this moment was. And you know, they felt like teachers should back off on, you know, giving them assignments because they were working this out and they needed their energies to, you know, whether they were protesting. I don't think most of my students were going out, actually, but, you know, just processing this and dealing with it. And, you know, and some of the teachers were saying, you know, we agree we should actually, you know, that our curriculum should actually be helping you in this moment, helping you express yourselves, learn more about this, figure out what you can do. And some other students kind of, you know, antagonized those students. So it became a little bit racial. There were a few students who were Latino students who said some things. They didn't say anything that was overtly racist. It was just insensitive.
Yeah.
You know, they were dismissive of it, like that these African American students were overreacting. So
right.
it was very subtle, but
it was very
hurtful, and it became very. It was a lot of antipathy, and then, you know, and then immediately it goes to like, you know, us versus them, and a lot of the Latino students were like, hey, I didn't say that and I don't feel that way. I'm right with you, but you know, and then it just, you know, it kind of blew up, but that's, you know, but that kind of thing I consider a very productive moment because really what you're finding out is what people are feeling already. If there's
right.
racial tension,
right.
we should know about it and we should start to deal with it. And, you know, and I did a lot of talking to a lot of kids about that, about how they reacted, what they said and what it meant and their responsibility, you know, for somebody else's reaction to it.
Right.
And it was a teachable moment,
right.
but you know, I think probably my guess is there may be less cyberbullying because kids aren't seeing each other at school and antagonizing each other in that way.
No, that's true.
I think a lot of it starts with, you know, somebody looks at somebody else. Somebody.
And they start saying things back and forth.
A girl likes two girls like a guy, and he likes one of them, and the other one's, you know, without all the school drama, I think we may be having less of that. You know, that's probably been, you know, made things easier. The problem is isolating kids doesn't help them. It's just, it like stunts their, because all that drama is part of them growing up, you know, experiencing that. I think we can, by the way, I think we can do a much better job of preventing it from getting hurtful. I think, you know, I think we're not really, we don't really have a handle on it. Most educators, I think there's a lot of delusion that I hear from students who say, you know, you guys think we all get along, but we don't. Like, there's a lot that we, the adults on the school, don't know about. Right. And, you know, we don't necessarily do a good enough job of maintaining that kind of collegiality and respect.
Well, I have one more question for you, and I don't know if John has anything, and then maybe you could give us your ending thoughts of the of your, what you think. But my last question is, have you been saying anything to the kids? I'm assuming teachers are having a tough time with, you know, what has transpired going on. And my opinion is, let's not destroy history. Let's make history. Have you, what is your opinion, or what have you had to say to the kids in regard to how, you know, what happened in regards to, you know, tearing down statues and everything? That's history. You know what I mean? So we can't change it, but let's make history. So, I mean, have you had any instances with that?
Oh yeah. I mean, we talk about these kinds of things all the time. And I think, you know, I think the statue issue is a complicated one. And I think you can't really discuss it as one thing. Like, all statues are good, all statues are bad. Yeah. I think you have to take there are statues in the South that were erected specifically to make a statement to Black people during the Jim Crow segregation era. That was their purpose. Yeah.
Right.
It was not about history. It was about intimidation and, you know, white superiority, or white supremacy.
But it did play a role in history. Yeah.
Well, there are a lot of, you know, the Rosenbergs don't have a statue, you know, not the one Julius Rosenberg.
Yeah.
They were executed for treason.
Mm-hmm.
Sacco and Vanzetti, you know, anarchists don't have a statue. And there are lots of people who, you know, who don't have statues, who are part of history. There's no statue of Adolf Hitler that I know of. So, you know, history, I think history should be taught in all its stark reality and from all different perspectives. But a statue is a symbolic thing that is saying this person is important and should be admired. I don't think anybody puts up a statue just to say, hey, we should learn about this person. A statue symbolizes that this person's important, because we literally are looking up to them. So,
I think it depends on the statue, though.
But then,
like you said,
but I'm saying, like, the physical object of a statue. It's this thing that towers above us. It's almost always high up. It is. Its purpose is to be admired and to recognize somebody. Now, you know, the interesting question for me to explore with students then is, well, where do you draw the line? You know, do we not tolerate anyone in history who did anything immoral, even if they did things that are, you know, that are heroic? And I mean, George Washington can be faulted for, you know, for owning slaves. I forget what the story is. I think there was wives or that, you know, but, and certainly, you know, the men who drew up the Constitution, who allowed slavery to go on for another 100 years because they wanted the Southern states. I mean, all these things can be critiqued, but I'm not sure that you say, well, George Washington, it had no value to us, when in fact he prevented the United States from becoming a monarchy. He, you know, he came, he, he saw this vision of government by the people. And so I don't even know that it one outweighs the other, but it just, it'd be a shame to just negate his contribution altogether. I think that's wrong. I think you got to look at, you know,
well, that's what I
what,
meant.
The good and the bad.
Those are the statues I meant. I mean, you can't change history.
Oh yeah. Abraham Lincoln,
right.
You know, now Christopher Columbus, that's debatable. Christopher Columbus, I think, you know, upon reflection, he, you know, was his accomplishment, you know, should we recognize him as a hero? Can you recognize him as a hero without negating the humanity of the native people of this country? That's debatable, I think. I think you can have a discussion about that.
Yeah, everybody's got an opinion about everything, so. Both sides, you know, every side. Yeah, everybody's got a side, you know, about how
well,
they feel about
and
it.
And I think, you know, and my job as a teacher is, can you make a good argument? Can
right.
you make a logical argument? Can you support your argument with evidence? Can you show the logical consistencies in it? Can you show the moral aspects of it? I think these things are very important to discuss with kids. I think that's what our curriculum should all spring from, just that, the questions the students are trying to figure out in this moment. I think that's how we stay relevant in a little box on a computer screen, you know, on Zoom or some other conference platform. That's how we stay relevant as teachers, as educators, even though our kids, we're not babysitting your kids anymore. We're not doing you that service because we can't, but we can occupy them and we can occupy their minds and we can help them discover, you know, their own enlightenment.
Wow. That's really great. Any closing thoughts in regard to what you see happening or what we want to happen? But I mean,
I got a question for Larry.
Oh, please.
Go ahead, honey.
Yeah, look, we're watching all the protests in all the cities and everything, and it seems to be a lot of young kids, you know, especially with the Black Lives Matter movement, and there's a lot of white kids. Young girls and boys fighting. And if you ask the right-wing people, they say, well, you know, the schools have become indoctrination centers with the teachers teaching them Marxism and socialism and to hate America. Do you see that in your schools? And what do you tell these people that, you know, what they are actually learning and, you know, what makes them... What makes these young kids go out and fight for all these causes?
Well, you know,
it's a loaded question.
I will say to the right wing. No, I like the question. I would say to the people who say that we're indoctrinating kids that I have seen teachers who are a little bit. who are in that regard who are progressive themselves, you know, left wing, and who are crusaders. But the funny thing about it is that they are often met with resistance by the students. The students can sense that they're zealots, that they have an agenda, and the students just see it as BS, and the students don't like it. They challenge it. You know, they say, you know, and you know, often they get the often those teachers don't are not as effective. The job of a teacher is to provide students the ability to think for themselves. And so if my students come to my classroom and tell me that that we ought to go to a planned economy, that we ought to that we ought to go to a Marxist economy. If my students come and tell me we need to equalize the economy, we need to take the money from the rich, we need to give it to the poor, my job as a teacher is to give them the counter argument, is to challenge their argument. Well, but if you do this, what will happen? Will this happen? That's my job. If my students come into class and say, capitalism solves everything, and if you're poor, it's because you're lazy, my job as a teacher is to challenge that, is to make them make their argument better and to make them see the other side of the argument. That's education. Anyone who's indoctrinating students in any way is not an educator. But having said that, I will say that, you know, it's funny that I've heard that from the president's son. You know, he wrote a whole book about indoctrination, all that. You know, the truth is, throughout most of American history, history was taught basically as white supremacy, the total opposite. It was brainwashing, but it was of that kind. And in the 60s, it flipped. And the result of that flip is that some people went to the other extreme, and others of us who are real educators said, we're not going to indoctrinate kids. That's not our job. Our job is to help kids understand the world around them and their lives in it. You know, and, you know, why, how come, you know, at one time in my class, you know, one time in my teaching career, half my students had fathers who were incarcerated. And, you know, some of them probably needed to be incarcerated. Others were just caught up in the drug war. And, you know, and those kids needed to know, because the kids' attitude was like, it's racism. They just want to lock up every black guy. And I understood them feeling that way, because it seemed like everybody had somebody in prison. But my job is to say, let's look at the reality. Let's look at how the law does discriminate. Find how the law does discriminate. Don't just say it's racism. Find out how it's racist. What are the specific ways in which, and you can find it out. The evidence is there. You know, there's factual evidence to back it up. How, you know, white people were encouraged to move to suburbs and were given low interest loans to buy houses in suburbs. Black people were not. It was systematic discrimination. That's why white families tend to own property more than African American families. Those are facts. You know, it's important for kids to understand, oh, okay, that's what racism looks like. It's not just a giant conspiracy. Oh, let's go lock up some black people tonight. It happens, but how do I understand how it happens? And that's our job as educators. And I think if anyone's indoctrinating anybody, and as far as I can see, it's not the system that's doing it. It's individuals, and they shouldn't be teachers. My son, he finished his sophomore year of college. He hates that. He absolutely will not take a class with somebody who's a zealot about anything. He wants a teacher who's going to teach, who's going to, you know, inform, who's going to engage, but not somebody who comes with a set of assumptions about the world and then says, I got to teach these children how to think like me. That's, you know, thank God my son will not listen to them and he won't even take their class.
I just want to say that my nephew was in college and he had a couple of teachers that he didn't agree with, but in order to get a passing grade, he had to pretend and he was able to pass. But
That's terrible. That's terrible. You know what my problem is with my students? My problem with my students is I have to beg them to disagree with me. I have to say to them, I have to tell them, you know, challenge me. Tell me where I'm wrong. Tell me why this assignment is stupid. Make a good argument and you don't have to do the assignment. Like, give me something back. Challenge me. Challenge the teacher. I don't know everything. And they go like, no, you know, don't, you're so smart. No, I'm not. I was dumb when I was, you're twice as smart as I was when you were when I was your age. And I'm not that smart. I'm just, you know, I just talk a good game. Just challenge me. Come on. Challenge me.
But Larry, what do we do with the teachers and professors who are teaching the kids their ideologies? And for instance, Bill Ayers, he was with the Web Underground. He used to blow up buildings and kill police officers. And he decided that it's more effective to teach the kids rather than to do what he's doing. He'd get more bang for the buck, so he went into teaching. And he's a professor now. And this guy, Bill Ayers, is actually teaching people to hate America and you know, the virtues of communism and socialism. And he's teaching our young kids. What do we do in a situation like that?
Where does he teach? Is he teaching high school?
Oh, I don't know. He's at one of the prestigious colleges. I'm not sure which college it is, but it's an Ivy League college.
Well, you know what? If you can get into an Ivy League college, you can sort out who's trying to indoctrinate you. Those kids will be fine. If they're smart enough to get into Harvard, they should be. My son is smart. My son could not have gotten into Harvard, and he's smart enough to know when somebody's trying to indoctrinate him. Hopefully. But the thing is, like, I don't even object. I mean, in college now, we're talking about college. I don't even object to a teacher with an agenda. As long as he's willing, but what you said about, like, you can't pass the class if you don't agree with the teacher, that's BS.
Yeah.
That teacher, I don't care how famous he is, he's not an educator. Yeah. And the college president should be shamed to not challenge that teacher and say, give him your best shot. Professor, but if the student makes a good argument, respect it. Respect a good argument. Otherwise, you know, you just end up. If you're right, then you should be able to make a better argument. But you should certainly be able to accept a challenge. That's weak,
well, Larry,
otherwise.
Larry, you sound like a really cool teacher. You're so engaged. Oh my God, I commend the.
I wish I had you as a teacher when I was going to school, Larry.
Oh, come on.
Yeah, you're really down to earth, and it seems like he's really just like would be a cool teacher, right, John? You know.
Yeah.
I try. I have my flaws. Believe me, it takes me forever to learn my students' names.
Oh God! No. Name tags work. Sometimes
it's embarrassing. Sometimes, like November, after they've been in my class for 3 months, a couple of girls will see me in the hallway. Hey, Strauss. I go, hey, and I go, you don't know my name yet, do you? I'm in your third period, and you don't know. And I go, oh yeah. Your name is. And I go, it's just like shaking their heads. Like, how can you not know my name? I'm so hurt.
Is Students First and Other Lies your latest book, or are you working on something now?
I've got a book coming, a novel coming out early next year called Light Man and the Roach Lady.
Oh boy, John, sounds like it's up your alley.
It's a
Light
Man
and the Roach Lady. It's a kind of funny, kind of wild adventure, character driven. And I'm writing a movie. Just finishing it with the director, Andrew Wagner, who did Starting Out in the Evening and Breakable You. We're adapting a book called The Radius of Us, and it deals with refugees and a refugee. It's a love story. It's actually a YA book, a white girl in the South and a Salvadoran refugee who's fled to save his life and his brother's life.
Very interesting.
Fled El Salvador.
Yeah. Now, where can folks get your books at?
Amazon. Everything's on Amazon. I mean, most online booksellers have it. Of course,
do you have your own website as well, Larry?
No, I do not. So they should go to Amazon or Audible if they want the audio books.
And what was the Audible one that Kim Fields?
Oh, Kim Fields. That's called Now's the Time. Yeah, the book too, novel. It's a good novel. It's been 10 years. It's been out for 10 years. But if you're into jazz, Anybody loves that straight ahead bebop jazz. It's a story, you know, sort of my homage to the great jazz musicians who I feel they should be those are the statues we should have everywhere. There should be a statue of Charlie Parker and Duke Ellington and Miles Davis and John Coltrane. Statues should be everywhere, and there's no controversy. Nobody would ever take them down. And while you're at it, statues of Beethoven and Mozart.
Right.
We put up musicians, and we'll have no protest.
John, I like that.
Let's be listening
to
music.
They did destroy a Jimi Hendrix statue. I don't know why they did that, but they did.
What?
Yeah, there was a statue of Jimi Hendrix that they defaced.
Oh, my God. That's terrible. What kind of a Philistine would destroy a statue of Jimi Hendrix?
Yeah,
that's horrible.
No idea who he was.
Yeah.
Well, Larry, any closing thoughts for everybody out there, parents, teachers, or anything during crazy time?
Well, be patient with each other and appreciate your kids, even though they're getting on your nerves at home. You know, you only get to be a parent with each of your kids once, and once they grow up, they're grown. And I so often mourn. I actually mourn the loss of my son as a little boy. I love him to death as a young man, but that little boy is not coming back.
Oh,
and
I want my baby back.
Yes, and so those of you who are stuck at home with your kids, see the positive in it. You're getting time with your kids. You're never going to get that back.
Yeah.
So
I
don't get to be with your kids. I don't get to be with your kids.
Right. And in my opinion, this is my personal opinion, please check in on them and make sure they're okay. Because God knows
what I'm
thinking about.
You know what? When kids are,
I do it once, at least once every 2 weeks to check in on them.
Yes.
You know?
When kids say, leave me alone, they really mean, thank you for checking. I love you too. That is exactly what they mean. Mm. You can't give, you have to keep letting them know that you care about them, even when they tell you to leave them alone. Just keep doing it.
Yep. I do it once every 2 weeks. We sit down and say, everything cool? You good? You know, what's going on? You all right?
And by the way, you know what? Hey, you know what, parents? We can be a resource to you. If you're at your wit's end with your kid, call a teacher. Reach out to a teacher. Just ask for help. I mean, we may not be experts on raising children, but maybe we have some ideas for you since you're trying to help with their education, or at least we can commiserate.
And you also know them on a different level than the parent does.
Right. You know. Right. We often know things that they don't show at home. You know,
home,
kids are often at their worst at home because they can be, because they know their parents are going to love them no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, but yeah, they're often much different than us. Yep.
Oh, man. Larry, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Really great.
Thank you, Larry.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.
To you. So, everybody, go to Amazon for Larry's book. So, he's got a ton of them. over 12. Was it over 12?
I stopped counting. Some of them were like co-authored, ghostwritten. I used to ghostwrite stuff with doctors and other people. But there's four novels. Fifth one's coming out next year. And I'm going to have another book on education, but that probably won't be for a while.
Mm. Well, everybody, Larry Strauss, thank you so much for joining
us,
everybody. And we will post on our social where they can get your books as well and where everybody can listen back. They know already. They the ones that don't listen live always go back after the fact and listen in their leisure. So. But thank you. So what a pleasure. Thank you. It was
great to talk
to you. Great to meet you.
Loved it.
And wish you all the best. And, man, keep kicking those kids' ass. You're doing a great job.
Right.
You're doing a great job.
Thank you, Larry.
You sound like a great teacher.
Thank you. Take care.
And thank you for being a great teacher.
Thanks. I appreciate that.
All right, Larry. Thank you so much. Take care.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Oh, boy. I think we could have talked all night with Larry about
I know.
Oh,
yeah.
Goodness.
What a great guy.
Oh, Yeah, well, you know how that goes here, John. Everybody we talk to is great, so.
Yeah,
but,
that's true.
You know, yeah.
Except for that one person that one time. we won't
we
mention any names, but.
We all know who she is. We all know who you are. We all know who you are. Yes, and let's just say thanks to everybody for listening and hope everybody is well out there. You know, I don't think about it other than with my kids because, like I said, I get concerned. I check in on them once every 2 weeks. I don't want to be a pain in the ass, obviously. So, you know, I check in and see how they're doing and, you know, have a regular conversation. Don't be a parent about it, you know. Just be cool about it and, you know, they open up. And what do we got coming up, John? Where is the calendar? Oh,
I'm not sure. I can't see the schedule from here.
You can't see Russia from your house? You can't see Russia from your house? I can't
not from
see
my
Russia.
Window anymore.
Oh, God. Who we got coming up? Oh, on Sunday, Lori Jacobson. She's an author of the book TV Dinners. She's coming back. She's a repeat offender. Can't wait to talk to her. I was supposed to email her a while back, and unfortunately things got in the way, but I'm going to shoot her an email hopefully tonight. Carolyn Hennessy from General Hospital on Wednesday. And on the 30th, we've got two great guests. I don't have them written down on my calendar. Why? I forgot his name. Oh, man. Oh, we've got one of the Brigattis from the Rascals. I know that. And, Jesus, he just wrote a book about songwriting, which is going to be great for you guys, you musicians out there, or you guys just starting out. It's The Art of Songcraft and how step-by-step how to write a song. I think that's going to be cool. So,
Before we go, Joanne, why don't you tell everybody about the nice story that they wrote up in the Observer?
Oh, yeah. The local paper where I grew up, I do work with them too because I freelance for them when I do my music critiques of shows that I attend, and I've worked with them for years, and they wrote a wonderful article about the show and, you know, and how it started with even way back with my whole career beginning in music and how the radio station came about and John and I, how we got together. I believe it's in the story. I haven't read it in detail, but what I have read was really good. John was my co-host and
I'm the co-host, H-O-S-E.
The co-host, yeah. Yeah, I know. That's why I said I got to go back and say, oh, you meant a typo, because I didn't know what you meant. It was a great article, and thank you so much. We really appreciate it. We really do. So thank you to our guest, Larry Strauss. Go check out his books on Amazon. And thank you to our listeners, always, our caller. We didn't get his name. So we should have grabbed his name. Our sponsors, the High Farm Bistro in Garfield, New Jersey. Pick up and delivery and limited seating due to social distancing. Wait in line. You'll get a seat, I'm sure. Delicious foods, excellent drinks. Precious Memory Video in Kittmersville, Pennsylvania. KWD Wines in South Africa. Teas for the Times and other stuff in Clifton, New Jersey. Syntech Productions, Lenoka Harbor, New Jersey. For all your music needs, recording. You just have an idea for a song. They can put music to it and just work with you and very inexpensive too, reasonably priced, and great atmosphere and great owners over there. Oleander Public Relations in Texas. Need a publicist? There you go. Need a new website? There you go. Take a Break from Cancer.org for Pete's sake. Wonderful foundation for folks who have been living with cancer and their families, and it's kind of like a Make-A-Wish Foundation. They help folks to a respite and just get away and forget about everything and spend time with the family. And it's very enjoyable and a wonderful, wonderful experience that I had personally with them. So, and Joey Max Hot Dog Truck and Cafe in Harrison, New Jersey. Oral satisfaction guaranteed. I have to try and get over there, and I owe them a frame stating that they are a sponsor and associated with the show. Unfortunately, I had the surgery and haven't been able to leave the house for long distances anyway, so I apologize for that, guys. So anyway, see us on Sunday when we have Lori Jacobson back and discuss her book. It's really cool. It's called TV Dinners. She gathered together a bunch of old child stars that we love from yesteryear, and they're putting their favorite recipes in this book and giving a little bit of tidbits about their life and growing up and being in the business or the show they were on and stuff like that. And it's a great, great book. So check it out. And we thank you all. Johnny, I love you. You know that. And we'll see you guys soon.
Okay. Good night, everybody.
Night. Take care. Bye-bye.